This is Huangshu Medicine Update for October 2004, Volume 24, Number 10. This month, our reports will include special emphasis on the management of menopause. Our report topics will include a look at research methodology, an update on gallbladder disease, vitamin supplementation to reduce health risk, hot flash management, blood sugar's impact on hot flashes, the estrogen intervention trials, and the weight loss diabetic connection. Our interview this month is with Dr. Joseph Pozzorno, discussing naturopathy and informatics. We'll complete the issue with reports on insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction, how the balance of TH1 and TH2 may be the key to aging, and a report on vitamin D and wound recovery. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland with the October 2004 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Well, this is a very auspicious introduction for this month's edition in that I have the privilege of announcing to you, the listener, for the first time, the topic and dates for our 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. Our 12th International Symposium will be May 24th through 28th, 2005, at the Westin Mission Hills Five-Star Resort in Palm Springs Golf and Country Club. Beautiful facility. I've had the chance to visit it, and it certainly is a lovely place to hold a meeting. However, the topic of the meeting, I think, will even be more interesting. I think you're going to really appreciate this 12th International Symposia topic, The Immune System Under Siege, Harnessing Information in the 21st Century for the Management of Complex Immunological Disorders. And I believe this is a topic that's right at the forefront of all of our thoughts and concerns, given infectious disease, given now the fact that we recognize that atherosclerosis is being seen as an autoimmune inflammatory disease, that arthritis is present, that metastatic events in cancer are related to immunological imbalances and inflammatory mediators, that we have type 2 diabetes and its relationship to immunological changes, and the list goes on, including even osteoporosis. So this particular symposium, the 12th International Symposium, will be focusing on what do we know about the immune system under siege, given a 21st century perspective, and how can we harness these new discoveries to ameliorate, manage, prevent specific types of disorders that cut across the spectrum of immune imbalances. And I think the program, as it's been designed by the curriculum committee and the plenary lectures and the workshops that are going to be associated with this topic, will give it a whole new way of looking at immune system function than that which we in the past have been given. It will give much more tailored evaluation tools for designing specific therapeutic intervention programs for the patient based on their own immunological status. So you'll hear much more about the program, but you heard it here first. The 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, The Immune System Under Siege, May 24th through 28th, 2005, at the Westin Mission Hills Resort in Palm Springs, California. Now, with that in mind, what I would like to propose is that over the next several months, we will be introducing then concepts concerning this immune system balance for those of you who will be preparing yourself then for the 12th International Symposium. This will occur in the way of different little vignettes that I will introduce within the body of the information each month, and we will have some clinicians and researchers as visitors to the Functional Medicine Update that will come on board over the next few months that will help us to better understand these topics. For this month, however, I would like to focus on a platform discussion which sets the stage for much of what we will be speaking about as it pertains to immune system function in subsequent months, and that has to do with methodology of making evaluations and designing programs, so-called research methodology. How do we actually come to decision-making conclusions based upon research? What is the type of research that we do, particularly when we recognize that the immune system is this complex system that's there to interface what's occurring in the outside and inside world with our internal defensive mechanism? So it's a translator system, taking outside information and converting it into physiological functional changes for defense of the organism. So we need to know something about these complex orchestration of events occurring on the outside world and how that gets translated into internal physiological information, which is more than just one function occurring at a time. In fact, the more that the immune system is studied, the more we recognize it. It's a little bit like what happened in particle physics. You might recall that early on, we thought there were electrons, neutrons, and protons, and then we had these things called photons that were light-related energy particles. And then as particle physicists got more involved, they got to recognize that there were these subatomic particles, and then the subatomic particles had subatomic particles that were daughters and brothers of the bigger atomic particles. And eventually we get down to bosons and fermions, these fundamental particles that make up the nature of the universe. And we've heard about neutrinos and all these other different types of subatomic particles that help us to better understand the physics of our universe. Well, similarly, in analogy to that, with regard to the immune system, we've seen first talking about white blood cells, the neutrophils, macrophages, monocytes, eosinophils, and then as more evidence has accumulated, information has started to differentiate each of those types of cells into subtypes. So we have CD4 and CD8 and CD12 and CD10 cells and natural killer cells. And then we have subtypes of cells, each with specialized function and each taking messages from the others. So it's truly an orchestral type of association of these different immune components that gives rise to the symphony that's called our immune system. So it's hard to study the immune system one cell type at a time because they're interrelating with each other. Now, you're obviously seeing the drift of where I'm going, this discussion, aren't you? And that is, well, what about the standard, what we call gold standard identity for studying things in physiology, which is basically one thing at a time against the placebo, against the single endpoint? That's the so-called placebo-controlled trial. Don't we run some problems when we're dealing with this multi-component system with interactions of all the components and interacting also with the outside world in trying to synthetically design a study to evaluate one thing at a time against one endpoint with one intervention? And the answer, of course, is yes, that is a problem when we start getting into really looking at how we evaluate impact on the physiological system from outside agents, that there are many variables that influence these multi-components. So with that in mind, then, what about research? When are research risks reasonable in relationship to anticipated benefits? And that's actually the title of a recent paper that appeared in Nature Medicine, Volume 10, page 570 in 2004. I don't want to make this a long-winded diatribe, but I just want to highlight that in this article they're raising the question as to whether some of the research that's done clinically using the placebo-controlled intervention trial, the results that we get from that, even under the best of controlled trials, well done, are possibly marginal relative to the relative risk that they've subjected the participants to, because they're really not addressing the broader questions that need to be addressed as to how we stratify uniqueness within the cohorts that might be different in the way they respond, i.e. biochemical individuality, how, in fact, we recognize that there are more than one thing going on and we're only studying one endpoint, so there might be atypical adverse effects that occur. They're actually not atypical. They're probably reproducible in the people that have them. They're atypical because they're different than the average, and so we then start putting people at risk. So when are research risks reasonable in relationship to anticipated benefits is the question. And when we start looking at that, then we get into IRB reviews of various experimental protocols and how they then lead to clinical decision making if the studies were done correctly, and do they put people in the appropriate type of risk so that they're not at undue risk? What are the ethical questions related to placebo controls, knowing that sometimes the placebo is a very powerful force in medicine, and therefore it itself may play an important role in outcome that's not to be dismissed as trivial? And then how do we eventually answer these more complex questions that are the real world questions of what a person should eat or think or believe or drink, or how they should exercise, or what environment should they be exposed to, or what type of nutritional intervention program that's eating more than one nutrient at a time? As you know, food is a mixture of thousands of different nutrients. So these are very, very important questions that are really being brought to the fore that I think those discussions will ultimately allow a new system of information gathering to be developed and new decision-making around these multidimensional or multifactorial questions to be put in place, so that the gold standard, which is the placebo-controlled clinical trial, may stay as a gold standard if you're looking at a single molecule against a single endpoint, like something for blood pressure, but it may not be the methodology of choice if you're trying to examine other more complex questions related to individualized response to a complex environment. Now, let's use a couple examples. I've been kind of waving at windmills here, jousting at windmills, so let me talk specifically. Let's look at something like cholesterol gallstone disease or gallbladder disease, cholelithiasis. We all recognize that this condition is seen with certain epidemiological relationships. Overweight women are the most frequent individuals to have this disorder causing surgery, or the necessity for surgery. We recognize that the supersaturation of bile with cholesterol results in the crystallization of cholesterol into these stones. And we know that the bile is really a ternary mixture of three components, cholesterol and its esters, bile salts, and lecithin are the three components of bile. The lecithin and bile salts are solubilizing agents. They're amphoteric, and they also have detergent-like properties in that they're both water-soluble and fat-soluble to some extent, so they tend to emulsify fats. So when you have a bile that's made up of more of these emulsifying materials, more lecithin and more bile salts and less cholesterol, then you have a soluble matrix. If, however, the ternary phase diagram shifts in which you get higher levels of cholesterol and its esters and lower levels of bile salts, even with the same amount of lecithin, you have now what's called the zone of crystallization that can be achieved, and now cholesterol starts to crystallize out of that solution, and now you have a risk to gallstones. Now you say, well, what are the factors that contribute to that? Is there a single factor? And the answer, obviously, is no. Once you start examining the physiology of gallstone formation, you recognize that there are literally tens of different factors that contribute to that, many of which connect to lifestyle and also genetics. So let's take one of those many, and that would be the conversion of cholesterol into 7-alpha-hydroxycholesterol, which is the rate-limiting step for the formation of the bile salts, chenodeoxycholic and cholic acid. So that particular step has a specific enzyme, the 7-alpha-hydroxylase enzyme, that is genetically unique to that individual, therefore variegation and different, we call it frequency of conversion or the facility of conversion of cholesterol into the bile salts. So some people may be at higher risk to forming cholesterol stones because they cannot hydroxylate cholesterol as effectively into the solubilized bile salts. Therefore, their ternary phase diagram of bile becomes more supersaturated with cholesterol and having less bile salts. However, there are activators that are known to promote the conversion of cholesterol to bile salts through the activation of the 7-alpha-hydroxylase enzyme. One of those is a nutrient called vitamin C, ascorbic acid. So historically, there had been a lore that you can lower the risk to cholelithiasis and gallbladder stones by increasing vitamin C intake. For the individuals who have this cholesterol 7-alpha-hydroxylase insufficiency due to genetic polymorphisms, the answer is yes, that they may be more susceptible or more sensitive to than vitamin C intake. But not everyone would necessarily have their gallstone risk reduced by taking vitamin C. You can see we're stratifying now for an individual genetic type. Now, in a group study of vitamin C and gallstones, you might not find enough frequency of those individuals with that unique genotype that if you then treated average 100 patients with vitamin C, that you wouldn't get a statistically significant decrease in gallstone formation because most people didn't have that unique sensitivity. However, in those individuals that did, that cohort within the study, they may have had a positive result, but it would have been washed out as a consequence of them not being of high enough percentage frequency to shift the average data into the positive. And this has always been part of the difficulty in doing nutritional intervention trials with a polygenomic population, that you may be looking at only small groups of individuals who are more likely to respond. So there's one example. Let's use another example. The conjugation then of bile salts ultimately to become soluble has to do with conjugation with various secondary moieties, one of which is taurine, the amino acid taurine. Taurine is a sulfated molecule that helps to form a solubilized detergent-like bile salt. And if you had inappropriate taurine conjugation, that could also then lower the effectiveness of bile to solubilize cholesterol. It could lead to cholesterol stone formation. So some individuals have been found to have their risk to gallstone formation reduced by increasing dietary taurine as a supplement. Not everyone. And again, we might say, well, who are those individuals who might be most likely to respond? And it would be those individuals that have this conjugation insufficiency. So that's another cohort. Then we go on and say, well, what about those individuals that may have decreased production of lecithin, which is also another important solubilizing component of the bile? If they had an insufficiency in the ability to produce lecithin as phosphatidylcholine derivative, then they may also be at higher risk. So that's another subtype. And maybe they would respond with choline supplementation or phosphatidylcholine supplementation to lower the risk to cholesterol deposition in bile. So what I've tried to relate through this discussion is that diet as a risk factor for cholesterol gallstone disease may have many variables, and they're very specific to the individual genotype, and therefore a study that would just look at diet and gallstone may lose some of this discrimination in the noise, in what we call regression to the mean or in the averages. However, we do recognize that there are certain epidemiological associations between gallstone disease and diet which seem to stand out. For instance, the consumption of simple sugars and saturated fat is fairly strongly correlated with a higher risk to gallstone disease. Fiber intake and moderate consumption of alcohol is also associated with a decreased risk to gallstone disease, and high levels of alcohol intake are associated with increased risk to gallstone disease. So there are certain kinds of things that pop out of the literature as kind of gross epidemiological markers, but when we get to the individual nutritional associations, it requires a different type of study methodology, a different type of stratification. By the way, I've been quoting from an interesting paper or review that appeared in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, Volume 23, page 187 in 2004, around diet and the risk for cholesterol gallstone disease. What about things like multivitamin, multimineral supplements? That still is considered fairly controversial in some quarters as to whether it really is cost-effective or just producing expensive urine. I'm sure you've heard that before, because these nutrients just get flushed out of the body and the urine becomes yellow in color, so clearly they were not useful. Well, I think there's one flaw in that logic, and that is that if they were not flushed out of the body and they were retained within the body, eventually, in eating diets that contain vitamins, we would accumulate so many vitamins we would turn into a crystallized vitamin. And so you have to get rid of these things. You just don't hold on to vitamins throughout the course of your whole life. Particularly the water-soluble nutrients are always turned over. So the concept that they're just spilled in the urine doesn't really address the question is, did they do something on the way through the body? You know, maybe they had some positive impact on promoting proper cellular function. Recently, the Lewin group were enlisted to do a study on the cost effects of daily multivitamins for older adults, and I thought this was a very well-done study and came up with some extraordinary conclusions because, again, in order to evaluate whether the taking of a daily vitamin mineral supplement has value or not, you can't look in the day. You have to look in the month or year, and you have to look over a broad range of individuals, and you have to have the appropriate endpoints and markers that you're going to evaluate against to be able to determine whether there was any cost effectiveness. This particular study was looking at population groups 65 years and older and certain high-risk conditions in the population and see if they were mediated or modified by multivitamin, multimineral intake. And this included coronary artery disease, colorectal cancer, diabetes, osteoporosis, prostate cancer, and dementia. And as you probably know, we've discussed in the years of Functional Medicine Update many, many studies that relate to each of these areas, these clinical areas, and nutrient intake. But this was a population-based study looking again at cost-effectiveness of taking a multivitamin supplement. When they did this five-year study, they felt that the potential savings resulting from the reduction in the relative risk of coronary artery disease and improved immune functioning and subsequent reduction in infection through providing older adults with a daily multivitamin supplement is approximately $1.6 billion. This five-year estimate of gross cost of providing aged Medicare beneficiaries with a daily multivitamin, if it was to be employed across the board, would be about $2.3 billion in total for all the reduction of risk of the major age-related diseases, including coronary heart disease. The gross cost is incremental in the coverage and would initially provide additional or wraparound access to the multivitamin for Medicare beneficiaries who are not currently self-paying for their multivitamin. Thus, the net cost, if we took the cost against the benefit, that would be approximately $1.6 billion. That would be $3.9 billion of value. Taking out the cost of the multivitamins, about $2.3 billion, leads to a $1.6 billion net value to the healthcare system. Now, we're looking at gross numbers in this study. We're not looking at individual lives. We're not looking at individual responses. We're not looking at functional changes that might have improved quality of life, things like range of motion, soreness, sleep patterns, prevention of colds and infection, and things even like memory and recall and cognitive function, which we all know from Dr. Lindemann's studies that done over 25 years ago. There's an improved cognition in older age individuals who take vitamin B12 folate-containing nutritional supplements. So I think that this cost-effectiveness study done by the Lewin Group is very interesting, again, trying to address how do we really state whether there is value? How do we come to decision-making? How do we say to a patient, you will get benefit from taking a daily multivitamin mineral? I know it's going to cost you something, but the return on your investment will be greater than the cost if you just stay with this program. And again, we have to use inferential information often for decision-making because we don't have the value of a prospective trial on that person over time against the placebo, which is their identical twin living an identical lifestyle, to see what the outcome is. So we have to make best estimates based upon this type of patterned information. Let's make another example, which I think is a fascinating one, and that's hot flushes. You know, we certainly have seen a lot in the news, haven't we, recently, about the use of equine estrogens and synthetic progestins for the management of menopausal symptoms. And it was not long ago that this was considered the preventive medicine of its time, and that the conditions associated with postmenopausal health problems in women, like bone loss and cognitive loss of function and cardiovascular disease, as well as sexuality and a sense of vitality, would all be neutralized or would be managed by the combination of equine estrogens and synthetic progestins. Then the Women's Health Initiative started to give information to us about this association or this hypothesis, and lo and behold, we found not only was the hypothesis a little bit overstated, but on further inspection with multiple studies, it was found actually to be wrong, and in some cases, some women even have increased risk to those conditions for which they were supposedly being protected by the equine estrogens and synthetic progestins. One of the conditions, however, that's associated with this whole range of changes is the set of signs that women do get positive outcome generally from the use of synthetic progestins and equine estrogens, and that's hot flushes. The question has recently been raised over the last 5 years, where do hot flushes come from? What's the physiological mechanism by which women suffer from hot flushes? Is it an estrogen deficiency that causes hot flushes, and for which then the use of estrogen replacement is the treatment? And then a simple model of estrogen deficiency, flushing, and estrogen administration, no flushing. Well, that leads then to a very interesting revelation, at least for me, because when you go to the literature and you start asking what is the known mechanism for hot flushing and night sweating in perimenopausal women, and you expect that when you go to the literature you will find a definitive answer because of the wide use of equine estrogens, at one time being the number one prescribed medication in the United States, you would believe that there must be definitive understanding of what is actually going on. And the answer to that, obviously, in the way I've described this, is no. We don't have, even today, a very well-understood mechanism as to where flushing and night sweats come from. Therefore, the treatment with equine estrogens was a symptom treatment alone based upon empirical evidence that 70% of women who take the product will get remediation of symptoms, and it was built on no real known mechanism of action. Well, when you start then examining some of the more recent papers, and I'm now going to a Journal of Clinical Oncology paper that it was called Cooling Off Hot Flushes, it goes on to say that vasomotor symptoms represent the most common complaint among perimenopausal women, with up to 60% of postmenopausal women experiencing these symptoms, up to 20% of women find them intolerable, and a similar proportion of women will suffer symptoms up to 15 years after menopause. 4 million women may complain of severe symptoms and are seeking intervention in 2002, and I would say that there's more today because of a greater cohort of women going through menopause. Women who suffer hot flashes may complain of associated symptoms such as depression, anxiety, and difficulties with sleep and sexual function. And women who undergo premature menopause often suffer symptoms that are of longer duration. So then we ask, okay, where do these hot flashes come from? The pathophysiology of the phenomena is not well understood. Estrogen action in the central nervous system is complex, and it may not be just estrogen alone. It may be estrogen metabolites like the hydroxylated estrogens that are also exerting influence on the central nervous system, the so-called hypothalamus-pituitary signaling. Estrogen exerts its function not only through an interaction with its receptors, but also through an interaction with other receptors important in the regulation of sleep, mood, and cognition. And so we've moved on beyond just 17-beta-estradiol to now look at the other estrogen metabolites and how they influence then these hypothalamic pituitary functions. As you probably recognize, there are non-hormonal agents that have shown promise for the management of hot flashes, which suggests it's not just estrogen alone. Dr. Charles Loprinsky at the Mayo Clinic Center in Rochester, Minnesota, has talked about the fact that the use of viloxazine is very useful in managing symptoms of hot flashes in women who have had hysterectomies. And this is a half dose of the antidepressant, 75 milligrams versus 150 milligrams, and there's a 60% reduction in the hot flash score in women who have taken this lower dose antidepressant or SSRI. So we now start seeing that there may be some interesting interrelationships between agents that modify hypothalamus pituitary function and hot flashes. Well, that then leads us to say, well, if it's more complex hormonal signaling than just estrogen alone, then what about other things that modify HPA axis function, like stress or like blood sugar and insulin? And it's very interesting because in a paper in Nursing Research in Volume 52, page 338 in 2003, it was found that the frequency of hot flushes was correlated with alterations in blood sugar, that when women had low blood sugar followed by rapid increases in blood sugar, that this seemed to be correlated with increased frequency of hot flushes. So this kind of hypoglycemic, what is called reactive hypoglycemia and dysglycemia disinsulinism, may also have associations with this flushing and night sweat condition seen in perimenopause. So stress and diet variables and hormonal imbalances in this complex web, not just estrogen alone. And in fact, we don't even yet know exactly how estrogen plays a role in modifying flushing frequency or the mechanism of flushing. Well, with that in mind, then the complex interaction for a program developed for a woman with menopausal symptoms would be more than just a simple intervention with mixed conjugated equine estrogens. It might be diet and stress reduction and lifestyle modification and a regular exercise program, that these have been found to modify and ameliorate hormonal imbalances that are associated then with the onset and symptoms of menopause. You'll notice that this is a much more complicated thing to define, however, than just a pill against a single endpoint. Now we're talking once again about polyfunctional or multifactorial agents and their relationship with multiple symptomatologies. And it's more than just flushing. The woman may have disturbance and lowered quality of life as a consequence of the flushing and night sweats, but what about her other risk of cardiovascular disease, cognitive decline, bone loss, and so forth? In these areas, we need to be looking at these more complex intervention programs that deal with all of these variables. Dr. Alan Warshawski so eloquently talked about this in his interview as a functional medicine clinician just a few months ago. Now, the literature is really coming to support this concept. If you've been reading the Journal of the American Medical Association recently, you probably recognize that there were a series of papers published in 2004, volume 291, say page 1621 in 2004, about postmenopausal estrogen for treatment of hot flushes, in which they said that yes, there is certain strong evidence supporting the reduction in that as a clinical endpoint, but that it doesn't appear to have any other very significant benefit other than modification of that endpoint. So the other risk factors may still be present, and the woman may actually be persuaded, in quote, to think she's okay because her symptoms are going down, but yet she still has increasing relative risk to cognitive decline, cardiovascular disease, and bone loss. So I think that these are very, very interesting parts of the story. Sometimes interrupting the symptoms is like taking the smoke detector out of the upstairs bedroom in your children's bedrooms. You know, you don't hear it go off, and so you think everything is fine, but you still have the fire to worry about. So in these studies that have recently appeared in the Journal of American Medical Association, and I guess this is the best quote I could give you, this is the paper entitled Effects of Conjugated Equine Estrogen in Postmenopausal Women with Hysterectomy, the WHI Randomized Controlled Trial Data. They go on to say in the last sentence of the conclusion, thus conjugated equine estrogen should not be recommended for chronic disease prevention in postmenopausal women. Well, that's a very different type of conclusion than we were led to believe just a few years ago. And in fact, in the editorial that follows these papers entitled The WHI Estrogen Alone Trial, do things look any better? And the answer was no, that moving away from conjugated equine estrogens to estradiol itself, there still did not appear to be a significant benefit on these other health risks by estrogen intervention alone. So they go on to say, in the absence of evidence for an overall net benefit of postmenopausal treatment with estrogen alone, and with the evidence that estrogen plus progestin is harmful, neither therapy should be used for preventing disease. Although it is possible that other forms or doses of hormones could be more beneficial, this must be demonstrated in disease endpoint trials before any hormone regimen can be recommended for disease prevention. Fortunately, there are other good approaches to preventing cardiovascular disease and fractures for which trials have been found to have benefits that far outweigh harms, end quote. And, of course, we're talking here about the lifestyle multifactorial intervention trials, not single agent against single endpoint. So sometimes one needs to question the double-blind placebo-controlled trial as to whether it leads us down the wrong path and actually misaffiliates a benefit against a treatment rather than looking at the total complex of relative risk and benefits. Let's look at another interesting example of this complexity, and that has to do with the weight loss diabetes connection. Most of us have heard through lectures and through the body politic and the scientific literature that excessive adipose tissue weight gain, particularly visceral adipose tissue, will in fact cause diabetes. And therefore, there's a direct association between body fatness and diabetes. Now, if you've been listening to functional medicine for the last few years, you've probably heard me challenge that hypothesis. There is no question that there's a strong association between body fatness and type 2 diabetes. But the question that we've raised is whether, in fact, the body fatness necessarily causes it, or it's one of the covariables that's associated with a metabolic disturbance that produces both type 2 diabetes, hyperinsulinemia, hypertension, cardiovascular disease risk, increased inflammatory mediators, increased adhesion molecules, and increased obesity as adipose tissue deposition as a consequence of the change of the physiology of adipocyte cells. So the real question is chicken and egg, and we've always assumed that the chicken, i.e. diabetes, came from the egg, body fat. And now I think there is some reasonable question to ask whether this is in fact correct. Now, it does not at all say that trying to achieve proper or ideal body mass index or proper body composition is ill-founded. We're still talking about the importance for maintaining leanness. But the real question is, what should be the major focus in our intervention? Should it be just taking off pounds of fat, or should it be trying to build pounds of muscle that then create an opportunity for altered cell signaling and a differential effect on insulin sensitivity? Now, with all of that as a long-winded discussion, you notice I'm once again going kind of away from the single endpoint concept of body fat produces diabetes. So the endpoint would be diabetes. The indicator would be body fatness. Now I'm looking at, again, a multifactorial component of how diabetes develops through these interactions between genes and environment, of which body fatness is a component. Now, the New England Journal of Medicine recently published a paper that bears in part on this question, which I think is quite fascinating. It's entitled Absence of the Effect of Liposuction on Insulin Action and Risk Factors for Coronary Heart Disease. And this is a paper that probably is counterintuitive to those of you who have believed that body fatness in and of itself causes diabetes. In this particular study, which was, I think, quite a remarkable study, they evaluated the insulin sensitivity of liver, skeletal muscle, and adipose tissue with the euglycemic hyperinsulinemic clamp procedure and isotope tracer infusions, as well as levels of inflammatory mediators and other risk factors for coronary heart disease in 15 obese women before and 10 to 12 weeks after abdominal liposuction. 8 of the women had normal glucose tolerance, although their body mass index was certainly showing obesity at 35 plus, and 7 had type 2 diabetes with a body mass index of nearly 40, 39.9 on average. Liposuction was found to decrease the volume of subcutaneous abdominal adipose tissue by 44%, so this was a gross liposuction with tremendous loss of subcutaneous body fat by the liposuction technique. It was 44% reduced in the patients with normal glucose tolerance and 28% reduced with those with diabetes. What they found is that there was no significant change in the concentrations of C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, or adiponectin. There was also no significant change in blood pressure, plasma glucose, insulin, or lipid concentrations in either group. Therefore, they come to the conclusion that abdominal liposuction, although it did remove tremendous amounts of body fat, did not significantly improve obesity-associated metabolic abnormalities, and decreasing adipose tissue mass alone will not achieve the metabolic benefits of weight loss. Now, this is to be contrasted to gastric bypass surgery, in which, in those cases, individuals that were type 2 diabetic do, in fact, experience, at least in the short term, improved insulin sensitivity. Now, in the long term, it appears as if they return back to becoming insulin resistant after recovery from the surgery some year later. So there is something much more complex going on here than just body fat itself, and I think that's the important takeaway from these studies. In fact, in the editorial that follows this New England Journal paper called Thermodynamics, Liposuction, and Metabolism, this is authored by David Kelly, volume 350, page 2542 in 2004, he goes on to point out that we cannot draw unequivocal conclusions from this liposuction study because this was subcutaneous fat rather than visceral adiposity that was removed, and we know the visceral adiposity is that which delivers directly into the major hepatic artery lots of blood fats, and so therefore it may be a much higher risk in terms of the relative effects on insulin and diabetes. However, notwithstanding that, and given the history I talked about with gastric bypass surgery, it appears as if there are other factors that are going on other than just the thermodynamics of calories alone in signaling for insulin resistance and ultimately type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease risk and inflammatory mediators. So it's something related to physiology of the adipocyte. So I just wanted to, again, bring to your attention that when we start looking at single agents against single disease and simple-minded studies, which has been the kind of gold standard, that we're often led to conclusions that are really not accurate. They're not really realistic, and they lead to clinical decision-making that in some patients may be quite good, and many others it may not be good because it didn't meet their specific needs. I think it is this revelation that's occurring in medicine that is going to really teach us how to be better in getting higher outcomes from specific tailored programs, moving away from the medicine of the average to the medicine of the individual. This has been the theme of functional medicine since its inception. We know, for instance, in weight loss alone, that if a person goes on weight cycling by repetitive weight loss, weight regain, that they develop an immunocompetence over time. This was recently published in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, that weight recycling by just focusing on calorie restriction alone may actually lower natural killer cell cytotoxicity and alter then immunological vigilance over time, making that individual at higher risk to conditions associated with lowered immune potential. By the way, this, for those of you following the reference, was a 2004 paper in the Journal of American Dietetics Association, volume 104, page 903, and the editorial that preceded it was on page 892. So one needs to be very cautious about making simple-minded decisions from complex data sets that are cohort variable based upon genetic diversity. And I think it's from that kind of standard that we will be seeing the emergence of a new form of medicine that is built upon a different decision-making strategy that will take into account these multi-parameter, multifactorial components to then start looking at cohort analysis and individualizing treatment from those specific characteristics of the group. With that in mind, let's move to our clinician of the month, who I think will carry this theme to a much higher level, and that we're very fortunate to have as Dr. Joseph Pizzorno.
Well, once again, we're at that portion of the Functional Medicine Update edition that I think all of us look forward to with great anticipation, and that's our Clinician or Researcher of the Month section. And this month, we are fortunate to have an individual that I think could fall under both those categories, as well as an institutional leader and really an icon in our field. And I'm speaking about Dr. Joseph Pizzorno. His name, I'm sure, is synonymous for most of you as listeners with the development worldwide of the science of natural medicine and naturopathy. Dr. Pizzorno and I have been friends and colleagues now for the better part of 25 years, and it's been a great privilege to watch the impact that his work has had on the field of healthcare. He's actually a past Functional Medicine Update Clinician of the Month, so we're kind of revisiting him now some 10 years since his last visit. Let me just give a quick thumbnail vignette for those of you not familiar with Joe's background. He has been effectively able to create policy change in so many areas that a list would be exhaustive to go through all the various accomplishments. But it starts with first working with a group of naturopathic physicians in the state of Washington to get Washington State licensure for naturopaths, and then from that, moving in the late 70s or 1980 period for the formation of Bastyr University, the first fully accredited university in the natural sciences, natural medicine area, and naturopathic medicine. He has been involved as a leader in education with the authorship of the Textbook of Natural Medicine, which I believe is probably the premier publication that people use in the field worldwide for really getting skill in the area of natural medicine, used as a text in many institutions of postgraduate education. He has also been appointed to the Presidential Commission on Complementary Alternative Medicine, where he was a member for several years in culmination of their final white paper mandate as to what needed to happen in health education and healthcare delivery to incorporate some of the concepts of CAM. He recently has been appointed to the Medicare Commission on issues related to financing and brings a natural medicine perspective to that group, which I think is quite a remarkable chapter both for him and the field. And lastly, but certainly not least, he was awarded in 2004 the Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award, along with an esteemed group of his colleagues that have previously won the award over the last 11 years. And we felt at the Institute for Functional Medicine very privileged to have Dr. Pizzorno join the ranks of the other recipients of the Linus Pauling Award. So with that very short biographical sketch, Joe, I'd like to welcome you to Functional Medicine Update. Maybe for those individuals that are not familiar in depth with naturopathic medicine, you can tell us a little bit about what the characteristics are that differentiate naturopathy from other branches of healthcare.
Well, Jeff, thank you for your very kind introduction, but more importantly, thank you for being such a teacher to me and to so many for the last 25 years. It's very clear to me that the advancements I've been privileged to be a part of would not have happened without your wise counsel and your brilliant education.
Thank you so much. I think we've had a very extraordinary group of people over the last 25 years that have both been our teachers and our colleagues, and it's amazing how you learn from one another when you get the right people together.
It's been a wonderful journey together. So you asked me about naturopathic medicine. In general, people would first think about that as a profession, and actually I think about it more as a way of life and a way of thinking about healthcare. And I think that what characterizes naturopathic medicine is not what we use, which is how many people tend to think of naturopaths as people who use herbs and vitamins and things like that. I prefer to think about it as a fundamentally different way of thinking about healthcare than is what has been seen in conventional medicine most of the last century. And what characterizes naturopathic medicine is a very strong philosophical basis about how to think about patients. We try to think about patients not as diseases to diagnose, nor as what therapies to use to relieve the symptoms, but rather we try to think about naturopathic medicine as understanding why people are sick and how to become healthy. So we're far more interested in understanding what are the characteristics of that person's own unique genetics, what environment are they in terms of toxin exposure, what nutritional deficiencies may they have, what lifestyle behaviors may they have that are setting up in their own body physiological dysfunctions that then set the stage for disease. So, for example, when a patient comes to see me as an naturopathic doctor with a condition like migraine headache, well, you can use a conventional drug approach like sumatriptan, which relieves the symptoms but does not address the underlying causes of the disease. Or you could take what I would call a green drug approach, and one which concerns me a lot, and what I see a lot of people using natural therapies doing, and that is they will use an herb like feverfew, for example, to treat the migraine. And while that will be pretty effective relieving the symptoms, again, it does not address the underlying cause of why that patient has migraine headaches. So the kind of approach I like to take, and one which I think is really consistent with what you've been doing in the functional medicine world, is to look at what is the underlying physiology that is allowing this person to get to the place where they're having this end-stage symptomatology of migraine headache. And when we look into it, we actually find a lot of reasons why that person is having migraine headache. And those reasons, those physiological dysfunctions, lead not just to migraine headache, but also to many of the other healthcare problems they're experiencing. So, for example, about 40% of people with migraine headache have a mitochondrial dysfunction. Now, about 40% of those with mitochondrial dysfunction, they're having it because they don't have enough magnesium in their body. So 40% of 40% means that about 1 out of 6 people with migraine headache, if you give them extra magnesium, either dietary supplement or by changing their diet, or by looking at what may be causing magnesium to not be absorbed or leave the body too quickly, that 1 out of 6 will respond to magnesium. But the other 5 out of 6 won't. And a lot of the people, the way they approach this use of natural therapies is they kind of do a grab bag approach of throwing a wide range of therapies that they hope will work, but without actually understanding the physiology. So I know I've kind of got a little bit of far afield from the, you know, core philosophy of naturopathic medicine here in terms of specific detail. But the idea here is understanding why the person is sick and how to help it become healthy by correcting underlying causes of their illness.
Well, there's a number of very important concepts that were embedded in your thoughts that I think I'd like to explore for a second. In the area of differential diagnosis, when a physician looks in the code book looking for an international diagnostic code, an ICD-9, often they're led to the belief, I think, that something like migraine headaches, because it may have a specific singular number, is a singular disease, that we could conscribe it and put a ring around it and call that a disease. The example that you've just used, which I know is just one of many, suggests that there are subtypes or subcategories of diseases, and so disease may be misleading if we start thinking of it as singular entities. Is that an implication of what you're saying?
It is. As you know, I'm the editor of a journal called Integrative Medicine, the Clinician's Journal, and I actually wrote an editorial on this about a year ago, and the title of my editorial was, Is Disease Real? I meant to be provocative. Because if you look at a condition like diabetes, for example, juvenile onset diabetes, where very clearly the pancreas has been seriously damaged, is not producing insulin, the disease name, juvenile or IDDM, actually describes the physiological dysfunction. However, if you look at adult onset diabetic or diabetes 2, there is a wide range of different physiological effects, only one of which might be low insulin. Most often there's plenty of insulin, but the body's not responding to insulin. The use of the term diabetes in that condition, while it actually describes elevated blood sugar, actually obscures the underlying physiological dysfunction that the patient is experiencing, and I think leads conventional medicine to use therapies and agents which, while they may drop the blood sugar, don't deal with the actual problem the patient is experiencing, and so you still get the sequelae of the disease.
Well, that then begs another question, and I may be misstating this, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but in my years of experience in observing naturopathic medicine, it appears as if there may be two separate camps. One camp is a group that would be characterized as believing that the understanding of physiology and aspects of even cellular physiology might be of value in developing a specific clinical treatment program for the patient. And another group that would say, no, that these are just artifacts, that the more we know about less and less, eventually we know everything about nothing, and so it's really better to deal with the natural history of the disease and to look at it in the context of the historical record and ethnography, and by digging deeper, we really obscure how to properly manage the patient. Is that an accurate characterization of some of the polarization that appears within the field?
I think that's a good observation, Jeff, and that is, in many ways, the field of naturopathic medicine is quite eclectic. I think we all share this core belief of patient focus rather than disease focus, and a strong belief in the ability of the body to heal itself if given a chance. Many of us approach that differently. My own background and my own orientation is much more biomedical and much more in the hard sciences. There are those who would prefer to take a more constitutional or whole body or other kind of approach. You know, people who use, for example, homeopathy will not get into the biochemistry the way I would. They would use the homeopathic remedies to treat the patient. There are those who are into the more nature cure side, where again, they don't really look at the biochemistry, but look at fundamentally changing how the person lives, what they eat, how they rest, how they detoxify their body. So there are many aspects of how this profession is practiced.
Well, when I first was associated with you and your colleagues, this was a better part of 25 years ago, as I recall, there were only two states that naturopathic physicians were licensed in, Oregon and Washington. I know that there has been a great extension of that now. How many states are naturopathic physicians licensed in presently?
Well, actually, it was 7 back then, and it is now 13.
And does that 13 include the recent addition of California?
It does.
Yeah, that seems like a very big step forward, the profession, with the licensure in California.
Oh, it is, because if you look at the population of California, the licensing of California doubled the percentage of the population of the U.S. has access to licensed naturopathic doctors.
One of the things that I know you have done a tremendous service to the profession is by helping develop a curriculum that would be a comprehensive curriculum that would take students from their first year right on up through graduation. It was incorporated within the Bastyr University program successfully. Have you seen the development of the curriculum and the increased activity of the American Association of Naturopathic Professionals and the textbook all leading to a concept that can be transferred, that you can actually better teach it and introduce it to new students?
I think that's an accurate statement. One thing I think most people don't realize is the intensity of the education that the naturopathic doctor receives. To become a licensed naturopathic doctor, a student has to complete pre-med, and then it's a 4-year graduate school education. During that 4-year education, the students study all the conventional basic sciences, basic medical sciences, and all the standard diagnostic procedures, but they also study all the more natural diagnoses and therapies. During that period, they also engage in clinical training and in the teaching clinics. At this point, there is residencies available, but they are optional in most states for licensure. So one of the changes I'd like to see in the future in naturopathic medicine is that there be a required residency for all people licensed, but the unfortunate resources aren't there for that right now. One of the things that's happened in the last 10 years especially has been bringing into the profession professional educators. These are people who have doctors in areas with which they teach and are developing a more consistent body of knowledge. And by having that more consistent body of knowledge, I think it's easier for the concepts of this medicine to be taught. And also, and I think equally important, it's easier for the concept of this medicine to be researched. One of my greatest prides in creating Bastyr University was our strong commitment to a science-based approach to natural medicine. And so we have quite a large research department. And what I say to people about the research is that we do research not to prove ourselves to the world, but we do research to get better. Because I think there's a rich body of concepts and therapies in this whole field of natural medicine, and yet I don't think they're as applied as well as they could be because they don't have the strong research basis from which to function. And I see that rapidly changing and rapidly improving at this time.
Well, that leads to a very interesting question that I know has been debated by scholars within the field of health sciences, and that is, how do you prove a hypothesis in a complex world where people are doing all sorts of things? They're not lab rats in an experiment. And in terms of naturopathy and natural medicine, many of the therapeutic interventions require complex changes, multifactorial changes, different than taking a single pill for a single endpoint. As we know, the double-blind placebo-controlled trial is very amenable to proving hypotheses related to a single agent against a single endpoint, against placebo. But when you get into multifactorial types of therapies, it becomes a much more complicated issue to prove efficacy. Can you tell us a little bit about methodologies and how these complex information sets might be handled to allow critics to understand that there is some substance to these associations?
That's an excellent question, Jeff, and it's been a huge challenge because so many of our interventions are multifactorial but not single agent. And I had a good experience with this with, I guess I won't say names, but I was brought in to consult with a conventional medical university that wanted to do a study on a chronic degenerative disease. We went through with this group of experts and we came up with monthly algorithms for the treatment of the disease. In other words, the person had a diagnosis, but we would not give every patient exactly the same intervention because they all got there from different pathways. So we came up with this very complex, and I thought pretty sophisticated and well-referenced algorithm that basically developed about 12 different potential interventions that could be used for patients with this disease, but each would get a different group of interventions based on their own unique presentation. It was rejected by the IRB, because the IRB said that you can only use one single protocol and try that protocol on the patient. So, of course, that's what's being utilized right now, and what has happened is they've gotten a fundamentally poor outcome because they're not actually looking at how we clinically think about patients and treat them. So it is a challenge, but I think it's doable, and I think it's doable by being very consistent with what the selection criteria are for the differentiation of the interventions, and then doing appropriate outcomes to see if indeed the interventions as a comprehensive approach were effective. Trying to look at this medicine and looking at just single interventions or protocols that are blindly applied to all people does not actually utilize the understanding that this medicine has to offer.
I think that's really well said, and it reminds me a little bit from the biochemistry perspective of the evolving story around folic acid, that if you were to look at just the gross population related to homocysteine and folate, you might not be able to find high levels of significance relating to various diseases and folate status. But if you start stratifying for the MTHFR polymorphism, the slow methylator polymorphism, then the significance of your data starts to get much more rich and robust, because now you've looked at the individuals that are most susceptible to folate insufficiency. And the problem we've had in our history of research in the past is that we have lumped everybody together, assuming that they're all similar, and that regresses to the mean, and sometimes you end up getting no data of significance at all, in which embedded within that are tremendous interesting cohorts that either responded very well or had an adverse response to a specific therapy, but they all got washed out in the averages.
Exactly. I'm going back to the example of magnesium and migraine headache. If you actually do a PubMed search on magnesium migraine headache, you'll see actually a fair number of studies, and they're all over the board. Some show effect, some don't show effect. And the problem is when only one out of six people is going to respond to your therapy, unless the study is large enough and carefully designed enough, it won't show efficacy. But for that one out of six, it is extremely efficacious.
So that leads then to obviously an area that I know you have had personal interest and expertise in for the better part of the 25 years that I've known you, and that's how you gather information in this more complex multifactorial world and analyze that data. In the past, this may have been one of those theoretical questions that could have engaged long discussion without resolution because we didn't have the technology available at the desktop to be able to handle large data sets. But, of course, over the last 25 years, that's changed entirely with the advent of the high-powered supercomputer that we can now buy for $1,000 from our local computer supply store, and we can crunch data that previously only the Cray supercomputers could have done 20 years ago. So I know you've been an expert in following this transition in what we call biomedical informatics. Can you tell us how that may help when harnessed to answer some of these questions?
Well, thank you, Jeff, for the opportunity to speak about this. This is the work I've been doing since I left Bastyr University in 2000. I've had a long-term interest in the use of artificial intelligence as tools to assist clinicians for dealing with these complex situations. And the example of migraine is a very good one. My thinking was that if indeed this approach to healthcare makes sense, that is, of understanding the patient's unique physiology, then how do we go about understanding that physiology and then determining what are the most optimal approaches to restoring normal physiology? So I came up with this idea of what if we were to map the body into about 5,000 distinct physiological functions. such as, for example, how well the stomach secretes hydrochloric acid, or how well does one of the saccharome P450 isoforms in the liver detoxifies chemicals a person's being exposed to, whether those chemicals are natural chemicals from the diet or drugs are given to the patient. Now, we think about it, 5,000 distinct physiological functions. How can anybody keep all those in mind? And not only that, how can anybody keep in mind what all the signs and symptoms of those physiological dysfunctions might be? And then once you recognize what the physiological dysfunction is, then how do you know what intervention is most appropriate for an individual that will most likely restore normal function? So going back to the example of migraine headache, my research team has now determined 21 distinct different physiological pathways that may be imbalanced in a person having migraine headache. But of course, it's different in every person. And those 21 different physiological dysfunctions, we're now at a little bit over 50 possible different interventions to normalize one or more of those physiological dysfunction pathways. So as you can see, as you start to look at this, it gets very, very complex. And that's one of the wonders then of the age of technology, where we now have very, very powerful computers easily available to everybody. And so by utilizing artificial intelligence system that keeps in memory all these physiological dysfunctions, and can also keep in memory all the reasons why they may become dysfunctional and what to do about them, we can then develop a tool that can be used by clinicians to understand which physiological dysfunctions exist and what are the causes and what are the best potential interventions for that user.
Well, that obviously then begs a series of other questions, and that is, if we were to see that a condition that we previously thought was one condition or one disease is broken down into more than 20 subtypes, then the question is, how do we differentiate the patient? So assessment becomes a very important part of differentiation. Other than just labeling somebody with a disease like migraine headache, we then need to know more exactingly the differentiation of their condition into the subtypes. So that then goes back to, how do we establish these, I don't know if we call these diagnoses or prognoses or differential assessments, but you get into the signs and the symptoms, the history, the environment, and the biochemistry as different buckets of information you need. Can you tell us a little bit about how then the clinician would make these assessments to go about making the differentiation?
I think it takes time for the clinician. If you look at the standard right now of 10 minutes or so with a patient, I don't think it's possible for a clinician to do anything other than make a disease diagnosis and a drug therapy that's more symptom-oriented than curative in nature. This takes time. It requires understanding the patient at a deep level, assessing the person's diet, assessing their environmental toxin exposure, looking at their lifestyle, and then carefully listening to it and eliciting the signs and symptoms the patient is experiencing so that you can start developing this physiological map of the patient. Also, I think it requires a lot of study of biochemistry and physiology. That's one reason why I so much enjoy your functional medicine updates and the conferences you put on every year, because it gives the clinician the opportunity to delve deeply into understanding these complex physiological issues and then how to recognize when they apply to a patient that the clinician is trying to help.
And when you look at this model, this is, sounds to me like what would be called a sea change or a paradigm shift in thinking, because we have so seen the primacy of diagnosis as kind of the sine qua non for medical training over the last 50 or 60 years, and now we're starting to say that's a good place to start, but it's not where you stop. You need to go on into looking at precipitating factors and underlying causes and the interconnection of those signs and symptoms to other things other than just the first-level diagnosis. So do you see this as a shift of that magnitude in medicine? And if so, do you see some signs that we're moving towards a tipping point?
Good question, Jeff. That is where I think medicine has to go. And it requires a lot more of the clinician. That's one reason why we've been working so hard on this artificial intelligence system, is to give people tools by which they can do this. I think it's going to take a fundamental change in thinking at the stage of medical school education before we can start applying the body of knowledge that's available to help people and give a lot more help than we give them right now. And if you look at the incidence of chronic degenerative disease in our society, as you know, most of them have gone up in every age group every decade for the last 50 years. It's clear that the current healthcare system we have is not working very well, and we can no longer afford it. Until we change the system, which is much more similar to the functional medicine model that you've been teaching for so long, and also incorporates many of the concepts of natural medicine that I've been working on and so many of them work on for the last few decades, and until those corrections are made, we're going to continue to have the problems we have with the healthcare system. I think it's great that we have expert clinicians who can make a disease diagnosis. That's useful to know, but that's the starting point in understanding the patient, not the end point.
So I guess my last question, we could go on in this discussion for hours, and in fact over the years we probably have, but I'd like to just take off from what you said, and my image is that maybe we're at a bifurcation point in the development of medical technology, that we will always have need for this medical intervention technology for people who have sustained traumatic injury or who have a crisis experience, and that requires a certain set of skills and a certain set of tools in order to do that well, and that may be this kind of emergency room medicine to keep the patient functioning. And then we've got this other philosophy about trying to improve function that would then stave off age-related dysfunctions that later become diseases of specific diagnosis that require this high-cost intervention type of medicine. And maybe you can't wrap them both into a singular four-year medical curriculum. Maybe we're seeing a bifurcation in the system to produce two types of doctors that live in harmony, one with the other, with differing skills. Is that a possibility, or do you think I'm off the mark?
Oh, I agree with you fully. We clearly need the almost miraculous intervention technology and diagnostic procedures typical of conventional medicine. But that's kind of the second choice, not the first choice, for the majority of healthcare problems people experience today. And I think that until we develop a primary care provider who has this conceptualization as the first line of healthcare people, and I think it's not an issue of information. I think it's an issue of philosophy and will. You mentioned before I'm the editor of the textbook of natural medicine. Well, that textbook has over 10,000 citations to peer-reviewed scientific literature showing that many of these natural therapies are indeed effective for a wide range of healthcare problems people experience, but that body of knowledge is not being used. And just as this, I think, a very sophisticated body of knowledge is being developed in the functional medicine arena, it's at a point now where it is usable, it is reproducible, the research exists to support its use, but until there's a philosophical change at the medical school level, it will not penetrate into the healthcare system and make the kind of changes that are necessary.
Well, I think that's a very good watchful note for all of us, because I believe, as you're indicating, that from philosophy springs action rather than action breeding philosophy. And it seems like we've pushed a model to maybe a point of diminishing returns, and it's time to start looking very seriously at the types of philosophical underpinning that naturopathic medicine, natural medicine, has to offer. I want to thank you personally once again for the extraordinary contributions you've made over the last 2.5 decades as kind of the voice of this movement and the rational perspective on the movement. And also want to really honor you as the 11th International Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award winner, and thank you for sharing with us your concepts today.
Wonderful talk with you, Jeff, and thank you again for the honor of the Linus Pauling Award. I was surprised and deeply honored.
Dr. Pizzorno's conversation stimulates so many different types of thoughts and follow-up questions. One of the many that came to mind was the concept that the therapies that we often use based upon single-agent mentality do not address the full complement of things that are necessary to get outcome from the cause rather than just treating the symptoms. And I'd like to go back to this insulin resistance beta cell dysfunction association that Dr. Pizzorno was alluding to. As you know, over the last several months, we have been discussing vitamin D physiology, starting with Dr. Michael Hollick from Boston University Medical School, and then moving from that to a wonderful discussion with Dr. Colleen Hayes at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and then more recently, Dr. Robert Heaney at Creighton University, all of which have given us extraordinary new insight into the role and physiological importance of vitamin D as a prohormone being converted into its hormonal form, 1,25-dihydroxycholecalciferol. Well, how does this then relate to the discussion of Dr. Pizzorno around insulin resistance and sensitivity? Well, believe it or not, there is a connection. The paths are all in a web interwoven one with the other. So let's talk about hypovitaminosis D and its association with insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction. Although the role of vitamin D in type 2 diabetes is well recognized, its relationship to glucose metabolism was not well studied until recently. A very nice paper appeared on this topic in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 79, page 820 in 2004. These were investigators from the Division of Clinical Endocrinology and Preventive Medicine and the Center for Clinical Nutrition at the Department of Medicine, University of California at Los Angeles. And I think their work demonstrates once again that we need to look at second and third level questions when we start developing individualized patient treatment programs for complex chronic diseases, because there is not one cause for these diseases like type 2 diabetes. In this particular study, they investigated the relationship of 25-hydroxy vitamin D, which you've all heard so much about in the subsequent interviews, to insulin sensitivity and beta cell function. This was in 126 healthy glucose-tolerant subjects living in California. Insulin sensitivity index and first and second phase insulin response were assessed by using a hyperglycemic clamp methodology. Regression analysis showed that 25-hydroxy D concentrations were positively correlated with the insulin sensitivity index and negatively correlated with insulin resistance, both the first and second phase insulin responses. There was a confirmation that these were independent correlations between the 25-hydroxy vitamin D and the insulin sensitivity index, meaning higher 25-hydroxy, higher insulin sensitivity. Now, why could this be? It once again shows that there is a very strong potential endocrinological effect on beta cell function, insulin sensitivity, and insulin reactions and glucose transport in type 2 diabetics, undoubtedly as a consequence of the pleiotropic effects of the hormonal form of vitamin D, the 125-dihydroxy vitamin D3. And so what we're starting to really look at is a molecule for which we thought of it only to be involved with the prevention of bone loss. This is Dr. Heaney's very eloquent discussion that he's had in our previous interview, to now looking at its pleiotropic effects as a hormonal initiator across cell signaling in many different cell types. They go on to say that because only glucose-tolerant subjects were enrolled in this study, we're not sure exactly whether this could be used to treat type 2 diabetes, but it certainly seems to illustrate the importance of vitamin D in improving insulin sensitivity and maybe helping to prevent type 2 diabetes. The observations indicate that hypovitaminosis vitamin D is associated with increased risk of metabolic syndrome. Why would this be? What's the role of the hormonal form of vitamin D in the prevention of metabolic syndrome? The role of vitamin D in metabolic syndrome was suggested by a recent report from the Coronary Artery Risk Development in Young Adults study, a population-based prospective study in 3,157 black and white adults aged 18 to 30 years of age from four U.S. metropolitan areas. It was observed that dairy consumption was inversely associated with the incidence of insulin resistance syndrome among the overweight adults in these studies. Therefore, dairy consumption may reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Subjects with the highest dairy consumption had 72% lower incidence of the metabolic syndrome. The role of vitamin D in insulin resistance was then evaluated by looking at the 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels in these individuals, in these vitamin D fortified milk-consuming individuals, and found that they were much higher than individuals who were not consuming the high dairy intake. So therefore, it now appears that the current study is the first to show the relationship of 25-hydroxy-D concentrations to insulin sensitivity and secretion when measured by the euglycemic clamp technique in a group of apparently healthy, meaning not type 2 diabetes, individuals who have various forms of insulin resistance. So again, this is an observational trial. It doesn't yet prove by intervention that type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance will be ameliorated with intervention with vitamin D, but it broadens the web of understanding of the role that vitamin D plays in various cell types as an immunological modifier, as an anti-inflammatory, so to speak. And we have already heard from Dr. Hayes that it helps to set the balance between the thymus-dependent 1 and thymus-dependent 2 lymphocytes, the part of the immune system that has to do with pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory balance. And one of the things that we will be discussing at length at the 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine is this thymus-dependent 1 or TH1 and thymus-dependent 2, TH2 balance and how that regulates immunological function. In fact, it's very interesting. In a recent paper that appeared in Clinical and Experimental Immunology, Volume 127, page 107, the title of this paper is, quote, "Is aging associated with a shift in the balance between TH1 and TH2 cytokines in humans?" And in this particular paper, they go on to talk about the relative increasing incidence in older age people of coronary artery disease, type 2 diabetes, arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, osteoporosis, which they suggest are all indications of imbalance between the TH1 and TH2 cytokine family, with a shift towards the pro-inflammatory TH1-mediated events. And as we recognize from Dr. Hayes's presentation, vitamin D and its metabolite, of the 125-dihydroxyvitamin D, plays a role in setting the balance of the TH1 and TH2 system. So the question that might be raised is this a part of the explanation as to how vitamin D could play a role in the reduction of incidence of type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, and cardiovascular disease relative risk? So we start looking at balance between type 1 and type 2 cytokines as an important for evaluating the outcome of several immune-related disorders. In elderly humans, it shows increased morbidity and mortality from infectious diseases, and we start seeing a shift towards TH2 dominance in T cells with a lowered level of TH1. In inflammatory conditions, in individuals who go on to have coronary heart disease or arthritis, we often see the shift the other way, moving towards dominant of the TH1 type. And so by understanding some of these differentiations in immunological function and balance and what agents are there to help set the balance, we might be able to develop programs that would modulate not just the disease, but the underlying cause of the disease that relates to this immunological functional disturbance. By the way, we also recognize that a low level of vitamin D is associated with injuries, wounds, and burns, and that may also have something to do with wound recovery and recovery from injury. An interesting paper, again, that appeared recently in the Journal of the American Dietetics Association, this is Volume 104, page 931, in 2004, demonstrated a very high incidence of low serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D in individuals, in this case it's children, who have had the trauma of a burn. They go on to say it's unclear why there is this deficiency of 25-hydroxyvitamin D. However, it appears as if the reasons are related to the stress of the burn and the implication it has on immunological function and the turnover of these active signaling molecules. So I think that what we're witnessing, again, is an extension and expansion of our vision, the simple-mindedness that we've had, that there is one agent that controls one endpoint is starting to wane. The primacy of the differential diagnosis is starting to be replaced by the concept of the understanding of the function of the system, and that we're starting to emerge what people call a personalized medicine that will be built around these principles of multifactorial interrelationships between genes and environment to give rise to the outcome called function. One of the important takeaways for us in this discussion, and Dr. Brazzono said it very eloquently, is that as we start to try to understand how to harness this information, we need to still keep it at a level that is able to be delivered in clinical practice. Unfortunately, we will probably never have all the time that we would like with each individual patient, meaning hours of information gathering and cerebration and discussion. So it has to be codified into a procedure and a system that will allow it to be applied cost-effectively and be non-discriminatory for those individuals who may be less advantaged. We don't want to end up with a medicine for the elite. We find that some of the people that need these kinds of interventions the most are those that can least afford to pay for high technology. So I think that the challenge is for us to find simpler ways of analyzing complex information sets and delivering to the patient more prudent information related to the management of the cause, not just the signs and symptoms of the disease, based upon this increasing understanding of function. I think that's a good place for us to end this month's Functional Medicine Update and set the stage as we move into November with our increasing interest in this immunological set of disorders that associate themselves with chronic aging disease. I'll see you next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.